Well, could I start this afternoon's proceedings by saying that it's a great honour to be able to welcome Peter Hansen, who is Under-Secretary General for Humanitarian Affairs. And Peter has been in office for, I think, about 3 months.
Not yet 3 months.
The point, I suppose, it's fairly obvious that we are here dealing with an area of United Nations activities that is of increasing importance, regrettably, I guess, of increasing importance. We are aware that there are an increasing range of complex emergencies in too many states in the world. We're also aware that the United Nations system has undertaken some adjustments to improve its response to these complex emergencies. And one of the agencies that has been created by General Assembly Resolution 46182, I think, was the Department of Humanitarian Affairs. And Peter Hansen is the head of that organization. I trust I haven't made too many errors in my introductory remarks. It's a great pleasure to welcome you here.
Okay. Thank you very much, Paul.
It's really a great pleasure and privilege to be here. I say that not only because it's a great deal more pleasant to be here in London than where just coming from Lusaka, Luanda, Kigali, Mogadishu, and a few other places that are not quite as quaint and peaceful and well-organized as London is. On my way back to New York, where discussions are going on the Security Council resolution for establishing a new, whatever we are going to call it this time. It's certainly not going to be a peacekeeping force, but a new force that probably will be historical in the sense that it will have a stronger and clearer humanitarian set of objectives than any of the other forces have had. When I'm addressed about or put questions or comments about the Department of Humanitarian Affairs, I am inevitably reminded that it is a very nebulous concept, isn't it? And it's a very vague and weak mandate you have, isn't it? And I can only say, yes, indeed it is. If you try to look at what the concept of humanitarianism is, or humanitarian, it is something about improving the human condition. But so is development, so is peacekeeping, so is literally everything else that the UN is doing. It is not as if it's a new concept. We have a humanitarian tradition in international cooperation for about a century since Solferino and Henri Dunant and ICRC and all that. So there is indeed a very long tradition for international or intergovernmental cooperation in the humanitarian field. But it is actually surprising that an old concept like that, humanitarian, is so well or so less well defined in legal use. Concepts like human rights and refugee rights are much better defined in international law than the humanitarian international law is, which is largely the Geneva Protocols of 1949 and various acts following that, but that doesn't go an awful lot behind or beyond the definitional state or beyond the definition of the rights and obligations of belligerents in war. The body of international law about humanitarian rights really is a body of law and practice that is under very rapid evolution. You see how nebulous and weak the concept is in international law when you see the nature of debates in the Security Council Sanctions Committee when you are debating. And I am getting requests from various sanctions hit countries about exceptions to the sanctions for humanitarian reasons. There are really no good, well-defined criteria for what are these humanitarian reasons for which you can try to shield the most vulnerable groups from the effects of sanctions. It becomes very much a case-by-case issue, such as is it a humanitarian mission to build a freshwater pipe from the inner lakes in Montenegro to the coast where there are large refugee populations concentrated without safe drinking water? Is it a humanitarian exception if you try to bring gas fuel, what is natural gas, in pipelines to hospitals and schools? And where else, where does it end? Is it humanitarian action to bring in basic medicines or even basic raw materials for medicines, issues that are being discussed in the sanction committee, without very much to go by except the exercise of a political judgment. In the colloquial use of the word humanitarian, you can look it up in the Oxford English Dictionary, where you will find that humanitarian has something to do with having regard to the interests of humanity or mankind at large, relating to or advocating or practicing humanity or humanitarian action. That sounds very good and has a positive loading, but then the dictionary goes on to say that it has a second meaning, namely in that the term is often contemptuous or hostile. And indeed, when you look at the way in which the concept of humanitarian action has been used and debated in recent history, you would see that the first on the ground in Somalia were often credited with a heroic contribution to that part of mankind, an assessment that fairly quickly changed in flavor. If you look at the Rwanda situation now, I think you have the same sort of knee-jerk reaction that the humanitarian actors who are in there now are really doing a heroic job. And to take sides, and having been in there very recently and seen General Dallaire and seeing my own colleagues from the department and seeing the colleagues from a few other agencies who are reaching into the north and reaching into the south in order to enable relief supplies to get to a situation that is beyond description, really, despite all the pictures and television coverage you may see. That is something that has a very heroic flavor to what is being done. But if you look at many assessments of the humanitarian action in Yugoslavia, you will find a rather broad body of opinion that would claim that here humanitarian action is really a substitute for other action that should be taken, and the humanitarian action is really holding up a solution through other means to a number of the problems in Yugoslavia. I'm not putting that forward as an opinion. I'm just noting that is a wide assessment of giving humanitarianism in the minds of some a bad name in Yugoslavia as a measure that only prolongs the conflict. And in another area that I have had to deal with recently as special representative of the Secretary General to the occupied territories in Gaza and the West Bank, it was very impossible for me for a number of reasons, not only that I had enough to do with my current position, but also you couldn't have a person with my title exercising any function of a different nature in the occupied territories, because there quite clearly humanitarian action is the last thing they want or wanted to see applied to their own cause and their own situation and predicament. If you look at the situation in Sudan today, you find similar arguments being advanced. You find it in a very perverse way there, you could say, inasmuch as we have a big exchange rate issue going on with the Sudanese government. The Sudanese government will give development activities and reconstruction activities the commercial rate of exchange, and they will give humanitarian activities only the official rate of exchange that yields you half as much or less than half as much domestic buying power as the commercial rate of exchange is. In other words, the Sudanese government is making it at least twice as expensive to have international agencies do humanitarian action in the Sudan as to do development and reconstruction action. So it is, I've tried to illustrate with these few examples, it is far from clear what that nice word in the title of the department really means in terms of the balance between a positive and a negative loading, what it means operationally in international legal terms, and what it means in the political uses of the term. I think title that I've been giving is something about organizing for new tasks. I don't want to give any correction to this because I discussed it with Paul and thought it was a nice and loose, elastic framework that wouldn't force me to sit down for weeks on end and prepare a learned thesis and provide documentation for it. So that's fine. But then I stopped up and thought, new tasks. Yes, there are indeed new tasks, but they're not all that new. I already referred to the humanitarian action and the principles evolved since the establishment of the ICRC and later on the International Federation of Red Cross Societies. But we really also have quite a history and a tradition within the United Nations that is often forgotten, and I hope that the historians getting around to write about the history of the United Nations will give a big chapter to UNRWA, the UN Relief and Rehabilitation Agency that was established along with the UN, from which a lot of the sort of heroes of international cooperation from the 40s, 50s, and 60s were really recruited from that UNRWA background. And UNRWA did a very, very remarkable job in the relief and rehabilitation efforts in Europe and other war-affected areas from 1944-45 onwards in the later war years. But then in their infinite wisdom, which we always ascribe to founding fathers of organizational systems, it was decided to disband with this general overarching organization, where due to the unity of the structure, you also had the ability to do all the coordination, and I'll get to that later on, that we seem to be lacking today, in the splitting up of UNRWA into four separate agencies, into UNICEF, into UNHCR, the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, into WHO, and into the FAO, that took up various parts of what had been UNRWA's mandate. And it has indeed been continuing in that the United Nations established a United Nations Disaster Relief Organization back in 1971. And it's interesting to look at the mandate of UNDRO, as it was called, because UNDRO's mandate was deliberately and strictly limited to deal with natural disasters. First of all, there wasn't perhaps the notion of the extension of natural disasters or the separate category of other disasters that we now call complex emergencies, but UNDRO did, in the course of its history, begin to extend into disasters that could not easily be classified as just natural disasters. There were also a number of complex political situations into which UNDRO entered. But it was only in 1992 that the UN established a Department of Humanitarian Affairs, and that department was created very much as a result of the perception that the international community was not organized to deal with such complex disasters as more specifically occurred in Iraq in 1991 after the war there. In the aftermath of the war, when you had the problems of the Kurds in the north, you later on also have the problems of the Shias in the in the marshes in the in the south, it seemed to the international community that the agencies were stumbling over each other's feet to move in a highly disorganized fashion. And I believe it was probably the only time that a G7 meeting took up an issue for action of an institutional nature in the UN, when the G7 at their London meeting decided to ask UN to establish, or they took the initiative to have established through a General Assembly resolution, the Department of Humanitarian Affairs. Now, to elaborate a little more on some of the principles that are behind humanitarian action, I thought it might be useful to go over a couple of the criteria that have recently been worked out for the operation of humanitarian interventions or humanitarian operations. They have been worked out by a group in which a number of organizations has participated. Many of the NGOs in the field of disaster relief, many of the various church groups, and many of the various UN agencies involved in it. They're called the so-called MOHONC criteria for humanitarian assistance in complex emergencies, elaborated and put out in early 1994, and they give five such criteria. There are other listings of criteria, but since this list is short, I thought it might be useful as a point of departure for discussing some of the tasks and some of the dilemmas facing the department. The five criteria are: one, humanity; two, impartiality; three, neutrality; four, independence; and finally, fifth, empowerment. And all of these words, I think, sound very, very good. They're plus words. Let's just implement them. Let's just follow these criteria when we do humanitarian operations, and it will all be very simple and fine, right? Well, yes, maybe, but they're not all that simple, really. Under the criteria of humanity, that is spelled out as: human suffering should be addressed wherever it is found. The dignity and rights of all victims must be respected and protected. That's a very fine criteria that says wherever you see fellow human beings in distress in a complex emergency. You move in there and you address them wherever they are found. Now, I'm also just back from a meeting that we organized in The Hague, en route to coming here, where we gathered with the 16 donors, or 18 or however many there are, the major agencies and NGOs, to discuss the emerging crisis in Africa. We can talk a great deal about early warning and so on, and that's very necessary. We do have an awful lot of early warning about Africa. Africa will, unless there are miracles in the weather for the rest of this spring and this summer and this fall, so they will reach record crops in Africa. Even then, Africa will face a food shortage of significant proportions. Should the rains fail, as they have begun to fail, it's not only the question of the amount of rainfall, it's also when it falls, the regularity with which it falls, etc. Should they fail, Africa is going to meet a crisis that is going to be worse, according to the predictions of the World Food Program and the FAO, than was the crisis in 1984. Because the famous drought in 1984, you remember the pictures of scorched earth and cadaver-like children in Ethiopia and all of that, that started a whole series of humanitarian concern. Well, unless all these climatic factors will play in the favor, the World Food Program and FAO, from their crop measurements and crop forecasts, are saying it is going to be much worse. Kenya, a country you don't usually associate with that state of affairs, Kenya is now facing a situation of the lowest food supply per capita they've had since independence. And the population has been increasing at a phenomenal rate, which means that you simply, with the same agricultural production rather than a falling one, Kenya is moving into being in a food security vulnerability situation that is worse than that of Sudan, and that ranks on the index about the same with Mali and Chad. So you go through Africa, you look at Angola, you look at Burundi, even pre-Rwanda crisis, you look at Eritrea, Ethiopia, Kenya, Somalia, Sudan, Tanzania, that is drought hit already before it was refugee hit, Zaire, Liberia, Mozambique, Uganda. The picture you can draw here is that contrary to earlier crises, this one seems to hit literally the whole continent at the same time. There are very few pockets on the continent of Africa where you can foresee any relief. You then have a look at what we, on the basis of these situations, have issued by way of appeals in terms of the affected population. It's about 22 million who are directly and severely affected by this crisis already. And you look at the response to this appeal. The response to Angola shows a shortfall of 60%, of Burundi 53%. Ethiopia is down on a shortfall of 44%, and Somalia 47%. Tanzania, as usual, because it's such a much favored country by everybody, but they even Tanzania has a shortfall of 84% of the aid that has been foreseen. So we talked about humanity before, right, so that you address everybody in need. But I meet with the donors, and we add all this up, and we come to the result that in food need and non-food emergency needs for 1994, we will need an additional $1 billion. And you sit down with the donors, and where's that $1 billion going to come from? Now we all know our comparators with what else cost $1 billion in terms of all the nice savings that we would have had from the famous peace dividend, et cetera, et cetera. But basically, forget about that. Donors are also under pressures, and they're turning around and say, well, what about prioritization? You have to prioritize. Fine. How do you prioritize? I just mentioned all these countries. I mentioned the crisis they'll be going through. Do we simply shut out a number of countries and forget about them, or do we say we will try to aim for half rations instead of full rations, or do we try to say we will try only to go for food in bulk and not for the intensities? It raises a whole set of questions just in Africa if you're trying to prioritize these needs for an affected population of 22 billion and things that can get a lot worse if we don't do the action now. So the principle about humanity, nice as it is, the greater part of humanity who are in that kind of distress raises questions about priorities that are very difficult to square with the principle of humanity, that you address human suffering wherever it is found. Basically, talking about priorities is saying, no, you can't always do that because we can't afford it. The second principle is impartiality, and that is spelled out that humanitarian assistance should be provided without discrimination as to ethnic origin, gender, nationality, political opinions, race, or religion. Relief of the suffering of individuals must be guided solely by their needs, and priority must be given to the most urgent cases of distress. Very good, fine. It's an excellent principle to go by, but exactly when you are in a complex emergency, that is, emergencies where you're very often faced with situations of war. And when you are in a situation of war, you are very often almost forced to choose sides. Or if you don't, you do not address the people in distress. We just have had the case in Rwanda, where in the early phases of the crisis in mid-April, you had a situation in the north where the RPF was fairly well in control of the situation, and you did not have systematic massacres in the RPF-controlled areas in the north as you had in the government-controlled territories in the south. Furthermore, the food situation was much worse in the south because they've had a massive drought that affected some 700,000 people even before the crisis broke out. So what do you do here? Do you move into the north in order to reach some people in distress and then be identified by the south with the north by having supplied their area, and you then write off your possibilities for moving into the south later on when it is possible to help that part of the population that is much greater need than it is in the north? Quite clearly a nice dilemma you are facing here. Do you roar in with the trucks? And many agencies will be very tempted to do so because the press is out there and they're saying, oh, there's a terrible thing going on, and where are the agencies, where's the UN, etc. So there's a great incentive to move in. We are here with the trucks, and we can be photographed and seen to be here, and we are heroic in the humanitarian situation. There is this competitive element among various agencies to be in first, and between the UN agencies and the NGOs and so on. What do you do? Do you say it is really unwise for whatever reasons to move in now, or do you leave it to the good humanitarian instincts just to get in, unload the trucks, and get on with it? Just to complicate the situation a little more, if you move into a situation like this, just urgently to address needs, how do you do that in a place like Rwanda in the south, where by the very act of bringing in humanitarian assistance, you might bring at risk the very beneficiaries you're trying to reach, by giving a very obvious center of gathering of a lot of obvious victims for the massacres that are going on. So shouldn't you wait a little bit until you can make arrangements for establishing safe conditions and distribution points? So we think not only of the security and safety of the relief personnel, but also of those you're trying to help. Again, a dilemma against slightly delayed action, but safer and more secure action for everybody concerned, including the beneficiaries, or roll right in fast and do the spontaneous thing and get first on the front page of whichever medium is there to greet you. Impartiality, think of the dilemmas of delivering aid to the Sudan. You are dealing with the trade-offs of being able to give a lot of aid to the south, but that will be conditioned to what you bring into the north to get the cooperation of Khartoum for some of the corridors of access that you need. Again, it is not always simple to be impartial in these areas. It also implies that we shouldn't have any extraneous agendas for humanitarian action. But here we have a long history of extraneous agendas bearing the label of humanitarian action. Only remember Japan and Manchuria in 1931 and Hitler and Czechoslovakia in 1938. There clearly were a number of extraneous agendas that you can often face in calls for humanitarian action. The third principle of neutrality, again, it says that humanitarian assistance should be provided without engaging in hostilities or taking sides in the controversies of political, religious, or ideological nature. Fine, again. But as experience has shown in Yugoslavia and in Somalia, it looks quite different when you are out there embroiled in a conflict to be seen as being neutral. And then how far can we take this principle of neutrality when we look at a number of the values at stake? When we were talking a few years ago only, action in South Africa, how impartial should one be in that particular conflict, or in El Salvador and other areas where we run into the dilemma of the neutrality of action? Independence, great. The independence of action by humanitarian agencies should not be infringed upon or unduly influenced by political, military, or other interests. But wherever you deal, you are dependent on local authority to deal there. You are dependent on a number of factors, even if that local authority is of a different nature than your municipal councils and other local authorities as they operate in well-functioning societies. Anybody in Somalia in 1992, 1991 and onwards would have had the experience of dealing with local clans and technicals, etc., where the independence was really extremely and very much at stake. I found it, when being there in July 92, embarrassing to be riding in UN cars with the so-called infamous technicals in front and behind us, protecting us, quote-unquote, extorting the UN and making the whole enterprise totally dependent on these thugs that were making an industry out of humanitarian assistance. Even though that situation has slightly changed, and it's an extreme example, everybody depends on conditions being set by the governments. To stay in the region, when you look at Sudan today, you really have a massive problem of when you're an NGO. I've just been there and complained to the Sudanese government about the way they treat and make mockery out of the independence of the NGO as well. It's difficult to make headways in gaining that independence with the government in Khartoum that would say we are at war. It's a difficult situation. Well, they are at war, but also they don't have the same ideas about the independence of NGOs as we do with our Western traditions in this part of the world, and indeed as many NGOs in the developing world feel too. The fifth principle is called empowerment, and it says that humanitarian assistance should strive to revitalize local institutions, enabling them to provide for the needs of the affected community. Humanitarian assistance should provide a solid first step on the continuum of emergency relief, rehabilitation, reconstruction, and development. That also sounds fine. I mean, you don't just rush in there with emergency relief that will leave a country dependent on continued emergency relief. You want to push it along to some sort of normalcy, some sort of reconstruction, some sort of rehabilitation, some sort of development, whatever that means. Great again. But when we come out from the UN and we make an appeal to countries to contribute, we have to make very clear, very sure that that appeal is chemically cleansed for anything that smacks of development aid. Fair enough, you have emergency budgets and you have development budgets, and countries want to make sure that they're not diverting resources from one budget to the other. Developing countries are very insistent. It's fine, give us the help we needed, but we must not just divert everything we have managed to get mobilized for development cooperation over into humanitarian basket case type of measures. And the temptation of the agencies when money is drying up is to say, fine, now we have an emergency appeal, let's throw in a 50-year forestry rehabilitation project in northern Kenya that we couldn't get financed in the country program plan. So you have all these tensions when you talk about the good principle of empowerment and the famous continuum from relief to rehabilitation to development. It was one of these things that I was faced with when I quickly came in, and I thought that sounds very good, and you can think a lot about that and make all sorts of nice theories and operational principles, until I 5 minutes later discovered that it could also be a prescription for an extremely oversimplified notion of a continuum, a unidimensional continuum from relief to development that could be used for by all the agencies involved for staking out where on this continuum does your business stop and my business begin, and how can we use this continuum to argue for as much possible turf as we could ever get in competition with other agencies. And I would never dream of imputing any such motives to any of my dear colleagues in any of the agencies, intergovernmental or non-governmental or whatever. But it just sometimes seems to happen that way, that it and that it does become a criterion for turf battle. Paul, how much time have I got left before insomnia or the opposite of mine? I'm very jet lagged, so I'll probably fall asleep before you do.
10 minutes, 15 minutes.
Okay. Now, I haven't said much about organizing yet, except I've hoped to illustrate that with all these self-evident principles that should make it very easy to take clear action, that it is not so simple. Organizing a department like this runs into some of the dilemmas I started out discussing, that we have a United Nations system that has a certain history and a certain philosophy behind it. You heard in the description of the NGO problematique that there was a certain functionalist school of thought, and there was another school of thought, and we all know this Mitrany and functionalism stuff and so on. But what is important is that it actually played a role in the design of the UN system, and even more, in the design of the second generation UN system as you had new agencies added onto it. And it just so happens that all these agencies, they have their own budgets, they have their own executive, in WHO and FAO, they are elected. In UNICEF, the WFP and UNDP and the World Food Program, they are appointed. It makes a difference, but not so too much within the period of the appointment. So all these agencies are quite independent, and they have had a fairly long history of often very successful operations, and they have built up a great deal of competence in the field. And if there's anything that, if there's any law in organizations, national or international, it is that coordinators are looked upon as unnecessary intruders who really have no business poking their nose into what we are doing already so competently that no mere coordinator can possibly improve upon it. That is the very understandable political or psychological frame of mind of such organizations. And furthermore, they have the formal independence. So it is not so easy to come and set up a little apart department and say, now I will come and coordinate all of you. Well, if you had a very strong department, if you had a lot of financial clout and so on and so forth, it might be easier. But we don't have that either. Furthermore, the Department of Humanitarian Affairs was not established from scratch, from a design. It was brought together by the former disaster relief organization, by the former Director General's office in the UN, by the various bits and pieces from early warning in the political department, and I've probably forgotten a lot more, but it was really a hodgepodge, if you will, of various parts of the UN that was quickly being restructured. It was located in New York, and it was located in Geneva. In Geneva, it was located at two different places that it takes 15 minutes to travel between. So guess what? A lot of the people who work in the Palais des Nations don't really know the people who are working in Petit Séquenet, and some of them don't want to know them because that would disturb their little field of work within the organization. So it isn't altogether easy to coordinate just the department that has been established to coordinate all the others, but hopefully we'll eventually get that done. Now, we do have a number of instruments that we can use for coordination, and if I say that it's all very difficult, I would also say that, and I can still say that, having been there only 2 months, so I'm not taking credit for any of the results that have been there. They have been produced over a period of more than 2 months, but a number of real results have been achieved in this area of emergency coordination. First of all, we have a so-called Central Emergency Revolving Fund. That will enable agencies to start up very quickly, immediately. They can enter into action before they have gone out to ask with the begging bowl to get a little money for humanitarian action. So when a crisis breaks out, UNHCR does not have any funds to start it up, or UNICEF doesn't, or the World Food Program, we can say, here's $5 million, you start today, and as soon as your appeals come in, you pay us the $5 million back. It's really just a cash flow mechanism, but it facilitates and it smooths up very much. We have a very well elaborated now system of partial early warning systems. We don't yet have the big integrated one, but there are a number of very good early warning systems, especially when it comes to drought and so on, and they are developed by FAO and the WFP, or run by these agencies. We have a mechanism called consolidated appeals, which means that governments are no longer faced with a whole series of appeals worked out on different criteria and so on, landing on their desks to ask for money when a crisis breaks out. This system has really made it a lot easier to know what is going to be needed overall. from an assessment of the needs in a crisis situation. And once those needs have been established, governments can contribute, and we have a fairly sophisticated financial tracking system that will keep track of where these resources are coming in. We have an interagency standing committee with the heads of all the major humanitarian agencies that can meet and take concrete decisions and agree on a number of important indispensable criteria, such as the integrity of the humanitarian mandate vis-a-vis military action and so on, and how do we translate that into field guidelines. And finally, we have a set of field structures that we have been able to set up, usually very quickly. In Kigali, this is something I can be a little bit proud of, even though I won't take credit, because it was really a number of colleagues in Geneva who set this together and said, let's go, let's be first there. So we were following, monitoring the situation from day one, when the plane was shut down, to set up a field presence, flying in with the machine, with the planes that were flying out the UNAMIR forces, and now being there so the whole thing can flow as soon as things had been pre-positioned on the borders around, and we had made an assessment, and we had made access to the storage facilities within Kigali itself. We are trying to, and sometimes succeeding, in making our humanitarian presence in the field an important and indispensable prerequisite for the operation of other agencies. I'm thinking of a thing like negotiating access, as has been done to some degree in southern Sudan, but much more spectacularly recently to the besieged cities in Angola. I don't know how much you have been following this terrible cases of the besieged cities, which were cut off from 12, 18 months from the external world. You couldn't get to them. You couldn't fly in, you couldn't drive in. They couldn't get out because instead of the walls on the ground, they have walls in the ground with all the landmines that are planted all around them. So negotiating access with UNITA to besieged cities in the former government-held areas was something that the department's excellent people in the field could do, and which the agencies could not do without. So what we are trying to do in organizing for these new actions is to provide structures, facilities, capabilities that add value onto what the agencies can do. In that case, they don't mind being coordinated, because being coordinated, they can do more for themselves and their own constituents than they could if they were on their own. And that's what you have to try to do within the realities of the structure of the UN system, where you don't get anywhere with a command attitude or with a steering attitude, but where you can only work through persuasion and facilitation. That is the fact of life. And those who called the person who would occupy my office when it was first established called it loosely the supremo, were really using very irresponsible language, because if there was something that would turn off all the agencies, and you could never practice anyway, even if you were a machismo, then forget about it. Supremo is not the verbiage or the associations you should have with efforts to coordinate humanitarian assistance in the UN, and I certainly shall abstain from a lot of things, including trying to be a supremo. So I think by now I've probably taken up enough of the time, and if, as I said, there are any questions, I probably can't answer them, but I could try or listen to your comments.
Do you want to sit to answer questions?
I've been sitting so long, actually, that I feel better for a lot of reasons standing up.
Well, could I ask four questions?
Sure.
I think just a few.
How does economic sanction further or impair the humanitarian activities of your department in the light of the crisis?
Well, if you take from a strict humanitarian point of view, I don't think you can ever argue that sanctions furthers a humanitarian situation. You might may say that sanctions furthers a solution of a political crisis by forcing one of the parties to go in. But that's an argument that rests on a whole set of totally different set of notions than the humanitarian case would be. In humanitarian terms, sanctions always hit the weakest persons in society. You can't really discuss that very much or argue very much with that. You can try to think of and design sanctions that would hit those that it should hit, namely the decision makers, rulers or whatever. And I remember discussing that in the context of South Africa, how the sports sanctions were cricket especially, probably that's a fairly upper class sport, isn't it? I think I don't come from a cricket culture, but airline travel by the people who usually travel abroad by air would be quite effective in terms of I mean. There are certain sanctions that would hit those who would be most vulnerable in policymaking positions, and there are those sanctions, and this is the usual register, that will hit those who are most vulnerable, even though you try to exempt food and medicine and so on. Can I just take a glass?
Yes, go ahead.
Sorry, but could you please say who you are?
Vanessa Piggott from Nottingham University. I agree with you that humanitarianism is a very nebulous concept, and you gave the definition of the interests of humanity at large. But I mean, as far as I can see, the reality is that humanitarianism is defined by the most powerful countries. And so just, you know, your five criteria that you've given, I mean, for start, you know, humanitarian suffering wherever it occurs. I mean, let's look at the mortality rates of infants in Iraq. Or, for example, you talked about humanitarianism on a case-by-case basis. Well, I know the case of the Red Cross appeal in Bani Luka, where there was they required oxygen bottles to be flown from Belgrade, and they appealed to Boutros Ghali, and he refused to allow the flying of oxygen bottles to Bani Luka, which resulted in the deaths of 11 premature babies. And then we talk about impartiality. Well, the ex-colonial power of Belgium can send the peacekeeping troops in Rwanda, but Turkey can't send troops to Bosnia. Or, you know, talk about neutrality. I mean, you've got now, is it to recognise that the UN approved the NATO bombing of certain positions around Gorazde to agree that that's, that the UN is now taking sides of it. And if we look at, for example, you gave the example of independent, the Sudanese government not understanding the independence of NGOs. Well, the reaction, most of the NGOs working in southern Sudan are Christian NGOs, and any Islamic NGOs have been condemned by these very Western traditions. You talk about Western tradition, and they've been very much condemned in the West, mostly in the House of Lords. If we're talking about
the West is more than the House of Lords, but
on the final criteria, the idea of the empowerment of people, you have a situation where Operation Restore Hope, you have a situation where the UN shot down protesters who were exercising their right to protest against a UN action in there, which is, you know, the Operation Restore Hope resulted in the deaths of over 4,000 Somalis. So, I mean, my question is, all I can see is real policy here. Where's the humanitarian?
I think you're making very much the point that I was trying to make, really, that these principles sound fine. I'm not sure that these are principles that are defined by Western power elites. I think that they have been defined by however you define power elites. The ones behind them are a number of humanitarian organizations. There's no government involvement in them. These are fine principles to act against, but I was just trying to say that it isn't as simple as all that. I'm trying to illustrate it with a few cases, and you illustrated with more. And all I was trying to say is that there are always some tough calls to make in terms of organization and action for humanitarian operations. And all I was going to say was it isn't simple, and I'm sure you agree. Do I appoint? Wait, sorry, my hearing is not what it should be.
Why did the specialized agencies withdraw from Somalia?
Yeah. Yes, the first question was why the hell I was appointed to that, and I really don't know. I mean, you'd have to ask the Secretary General what might have led him to such an outrageous decision. But you know, don't ask me about that. The third question about the withdrawal from Somalia. If you remember the sequence of events, it was a sequence of events that started with the killing of Dr. What was her name? I forgot the name. With a UN, a UNICEF doctor in the northwest in Bosaso, it was. And the UN... in my opinion, at that time, I can say, because I was not with the UN at that time, I felt was an overreaction, and I feel that that has been confirmed later on. The northeast and the area around Bosaso was really the safest of all of Somalia at that time. It was the only place, and I visited all these areas when the crisis was worse in July 92, when there was nobody in there, and everybody had basically... left, and Baidoa and Badera was on its worst. The only place you could work, you could walk on the streets with the local leader, whom I wouldn't characterize as a warlord. He was a very respected former minister. It was not Bashir. That's another one. Anyway, the leader in the northeast could walk in the streets without having a lot of armed people around him all the time for protection. None of the other leaders in any of the other areas could meet with you any other place than in a secluded, protected place somewhere, and that goes for ID and all the rest of them. It was an overreaction. You would have heard Mohamed Zanoun, as the special representative of the SD, criticize a lot of the action. You then had the reintroduction of the UN and the agencies into Somalia in the fall of 1992, where you could begin to deliver humanitarian assistance. Don't forget that that was well underway already when Operation Restore Hope went off. Then came the notion of Operation Restore Hope, and I would rather not, even though I have asked not to be taped or quoted in my present position, comment too much on that. I think you'll understand it. Now the situation in Somalia, and in particular in Mogadishu, is one that is focused upon as an example of humanitarian action gone awry. I would submit that Somalia is a slightly larger country than Mogadishu and environs. If you go to the northeast, if you go to the northwest, if you go to the interior, you will see an extremely different situation from what you saw well, 2 years ago or a year ago. You have really had the encouragement of using what remained of local traditional structures, elders, groups, etc., to get a process going again. You have made progress with repatriation of refugees back into Somalia from neighboring countries. You have made some progress with demining programs in the northwest. You have made some progress with a self-sustaining and self-reliant agricultural production and revitalization of the cattle stock and some of the exports out of the northeast again. It's not all bleak and a bad story, and when Somalia is being generalized about, it is usually from the basis of Mogadishu and environs where there have been a lot of problems. The second question was, sorry, can you remember that? Oh, lead agencies. The lessons learned from Somalia, and you're saying how come we could go into to Kigali so quickly when it took time to withdraw from Somalia. First, I'd like to make the point that the headline you see in the newspapers all the time, there's conflict breaking out. Now the UN is pulling up and leaving all over from the country. I say, of course, the UN should pull up and leave when a conflict breaks out and there's civil war in a country, because the UN is in a country in peacetime, basically with long-term development projects, with UNDP, with consultants who are thinking about health policies for the next 20 years or reform of the national accounts and what have you. That's what the UN is in a country for until war breaks out. And there's absolutely no good reason on earth that the UN should stay at public expense, international taxpayers' money, and have people operate there who have absolutely nothing to do in a war situation. The UN should pull out and the UN should move in. And that is what I would like to see happen, as the development people are forced to move out because they can't make any good use of their time or resources. The UN should prepare very quickly to re-enter as massively as is needed with humanitarian aid. And this is what we did in Kigali. We were in there, what was it, a week or 10 days after the plane was shut down. And we have set up in a way that we now have things moving into Kigali. When you take on the logistical problems of food, medicines, tents, everything that is needed, that is really quite a logistical feat that could only be carried out with that early joint coordination that we saw among all these agencies. And while I was telling about the difficulties of coordination, let me also say that our staffing in Kigali is not just the Department of Humanitarian Affairs. I have had people seconded to me from the High Commissioner for Refugees. I have had people commissioned to me from UNICEF and from the World Food Program. We have people detailed to us from the International Federation of Red Cross Societies, which is quite extraordinary when you stop to think about that degree of cooperation between the IFRC and the UN. We have been working out with the ICRC the criteria for operations in Rwanda. What are the conditions that must be met for delivery of humanitarian aid? That's, again, a very, very close coordination, but that is the sort of coordination that will be accepted because it was clearly of use to the agencies and to the NGOs that they could get all that information, they could get all that help, they could get all that communication, and they could get all that cooperation while maintaining their separate identities so they can go back to their constituents and raise money and so on. It is quite simply a matter in such situations not to learn oversimplified lessons. We should have a more centralized structure so you can order agencies around, or we should just let everybody do as they please, because, you know, then they can exercise all their decentralized initiative. neither of these solutions will really work in the real world. You have to be somewhere along in the middle of the spectrum where you can get the best of both approaches. Yes?
Sorry, there's a question over there.
Well, thank you, first of all, for your address. My name is Guy Suresh. I'm a teacher and researcher in international law. I have three questions. The first is, how can you pinpoint one of the key problems in this area, and that is of independence, the perceived independence of the NGOs operating in the field, as well as the UN. How can this better be transmitted? Are there any ways or ideas that your department has to transmit this to the armed forces which are operating in those areas? That's the first. And something which follows on from that, and that is the problem of the perceived link in many of these cases, for example, in Bosnia and Somalia, between the UN peacekeepers, who in certain cases might take enforcement action, as in Bosnia and Somalia now, and the link between them, the peacekeepers, and the operational humanitarian organizations. How can that better be rectified? And as a result of that, do you think that link will lead to greater pressure for fighting through assistance, for fighting through humanitarian assistance to populations in need? And the third and a half question really is, what is the role of consent, which your
the role of
consent uh-huh. of the authority in control? Does your department view that always as a necessary prerequisite?
Okay, let me start backwards, and I forgot to get a pen with me, so I didn't take note. Backwards from consent. Yes, we must always seek to get consent. Even in a situation like Rwanda now, we must seek to identify those in southern Rwanda with whom we can talk and with whom we can extract some guarantees in terms of cooperation to help them and help their population. The problem is that you may get such consents, but even with the best of will of the world, and I'm not saying whether that is present all the time when they sign on the dotted paper, they might not be able to deliver on it. The situation in southern Rwanda today, I think, is not too different from the situation in parts of Somalia early, where nobody is really in control, and where militias roam around, influenced by cats in Somalia. I'm not quite sure what they're influenced by in Rwanda, but I'm not so sure that it's certainly not humanitarian principles. But we must seek content, we must also be prepared to take whatever risks we feel we can take vis-a-vis both the relief personnel and the beneficiaries. And I don't think there are any hard and fast rules and answers that are applicable in all situations to that. You really must be willing to exercise political judgment in such situations. And I can assure you it isn't easy. The relationship between the humanitarian and the relief and the military in relief situations is an extremely vexed one. And the way you ask the question, I know that you know that, so I'm not sure I can cover it all, except saying that there are no simple solutions to it. We could not have gone into Kigali without having transport from UNAMIR, from the airport to their quarters. Where would people who flew in then? I mean, there was nobody there. There was no NGO. There was ICRC, but they were locked into their hospital in the middle of Kigali. They couldn't let their patients go out either when they were ready for dismissal, because anybody moving out from those hospital grounds would be in danger of their life. So we could only come in to set up the practical logistics and infrastructure by working closely with General Dallaire in Kigali, who, by the way, has been a real hero in all this, I think, seeing him in operation and being totally imbued with what we are here for is to do what we can do in humanitarian terms. He was down to 450 men then, and of course he wouldn't dream about fighting a war with them. But there was one thing that guided everything he did and said in that period, and that was, how can we help you? And one can, of course, say, well, we are humanitarian, we are pure, we never want to talk to a military person or have anything to do with them. You know, it's not that simple either. We have to work out how far we can go in working with the military and what then to do when the situation becomes very, very complex, as it did in Bosnia with the UN becoming party to the conflict and that causing problems for the UNHCR. Or in Somalia, when the UN became very much part of a conflict too, that reflected upon the entire UN operation, and not just what was directed in certain well-remembered actions against General Idid. Again, I'm sorry, as a former political scientist, at least, I would like to come up with general rules of behavior and generalizations, but I find my training sometimes somewhat useless in meeting situations that can only be judged in a or addressed in a very ad hoc fashion. And your first question was
how can the independence be better transmitted? I mean, for example,
in Somalia, very good question. Very good. I think there's a whole lot of lessons first of all to be learned. Then a whole lot of lessons to be written to teach to others, and then a whole lot of training. And I don't think we have any of these three elements, and I think all three elements are needed in order to establish humanitarian action. I sometimes think if I had a little research grant and I would have a team of interviewers go around to all the members of the UNISOM force to do a survey of them about sort of why are you here, and give them five choices or open-ended answer or something like that. I think you would come up with a result of such a survey that would scream to the reader that whoever knew what they were going in for, I mean, among those who were leading them, who could then be teaching the soldiers? How can you expect the people in the field to exercise any judgment which is called for every hour of the day they're outside, if they don't have that, if they have not sort of internalized and socialized a number of norms about what they're there, etc. All they talk about are rules of engagement, and I think that is important, but it's not the entire discussion. In a humanitarian mission, as Somalia is or was or whatever.
I'm afraid we have come, I think, to the end of our time. I think it falls to me to thank Peter Hansen really very sincerely on behalf of all of us. It's been an extremely interesting, illuminating talk. It's one of those very few occasions, I think, also, when I can say wholeheartedly, and I do hope on behalf of all of us here, to wish him really the very best success with his position, with his work over the next years. It's a very important job, I think, from the point of view of the future of the United Nations.
Well, Boutros Ghali might ask himself what you asked.
Could I just remind you, please, also, the people taking part in the workshop, that this afternoon's sessions are in room A245, which is immediately beneath the Graham Wallace room, where we were this morning. A245.